Comic Timing is a proud member of the Comics Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 20A of Comic Timing, a comics podcast devoted to the average comic book fan from the average comic book fan. Joining us is a rotating panel of guests and myself, Ian Levinson, discuss whatever comes to mind time after time here on Comic Timing. Well, surprise, folks, the two-part episode. That's right. David D., John Mayo, and I go in-depth in discussion of DC's most ambitious venture to date, 52. Is it doing what it set out to do with issue 1, and will the year be worth it? Well, we certainly hope so. And this recap episode is much shorter than 52 weeks, which is certainly a plus. Here now, Comic Time. Hey there, folks. My name is Ian Levinstein, and welcome to episode 20 of Comic Timing. Everybody's going to have to wait a little bit longer to get Steve Bryant on the show, as his car died on him this past week, at least his tire did, so he was unable to join us as previously mentioned. He will be on the show hopefully in 2 weeks, so we're holding out for Steve Bryant, but we're going to do episode 20 so we don't cause any confusion when we finally do have him on. And I figured what better way to celebrate episode 20 than to do a 52 conversation. And who better to have on for this 52 conversation than two folks who are very familiar with 52, joined with David D. from the Comic Geek Speak forums, who has put a lot of time in with Rip Hunter's Blackboard so far. David, how are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you on. Glad to have you on.
And Steve Bryan is worth the wait.
Yes, he is. And hopefully we'll have him on
hopefully
soon.
Hopefully he switched to his plane.
Oh, yes. He has many different way of getting around, you know, him being with the whole Athena Voltaire thing. He has to have a plane around for reference, so. We're also joined by John Mayo of the Mayo Report on Comic Geek Speak. He also does a column for Comic Book Resources, where he does a very similar thing with the numbers. And he is joining us today. John, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
Glad to have you on, man. Glad to have you on. And he is everywhere this week as well. Comic Geek Speak, Collected Comics Library, and now Comic Timing. So good job, man, being everywhere at once.
Hey, it's easier than starting my own podcast.
There you go.
John Mayo is the first comic book podcast pundit, I would say. I nominate him as the hardest working guest in comic book podcasts.
Well, that means eventually he'll make his way onto the Colbert Report, so.
Hey, that would be cool.
Hey, Colbert, if you're listening, which you're probably not, get on this. Anyway, hey, he is a fan of comics.
Yeah, I was going to say, he had Joey Q on, so.
That's true.
You know, I'm easy to find, so.
Exactly. So, track him down. Anyway, let's get into the conversation here on 52. And I posted the question, the main question at least, on the boards earlier, and this is what we have to say. 52 has been one of the most intriguing books to come out of DC in quite some time. With its weekly format, the comic emulates the form of a television drama and builds itself similarly. Wow, what a hard word to say. What is your current take on 52? Who are your favorite characters? Is there any aspect of 52 you would like to see more or less of as the series continues? What questions remain unanswered that you feel need answers? And most of all, would you pick up another weekly comic book if DC decides to make it? Let us know how you feel, and John, David, and myself will discuss your comments on the show. We have one comment that we'll read later on. But first, let's get to the guest's take on it. Well, we'll start it off with you, John. Your take so far on 52?
I'm loving it. I think it's a really great series. The one thing I would like to see more of is really more pages in each issue. It seems like they're telling an insanely huge story or stories here, and, you know, I'm constantly left wanting more, which, you know, is a good sign. I'm just impatient and want more now.
Well, do you feel they're rushing because of the page count at all, or...?
I don't think it's so much rushing. It just feels like various storylines get introduced and then you don't hear anything about them for, you know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, or a month or two. And I attribute a lot of that just to the epic scope of the story. You know, it's not a matter, again, of rushing or any kind of decompression or anything of that sort. Just they're juggling so many, you know, characters, plot lines, places, things, events, whatever. That, you know, stuff I want to see them go back to. It's hard for them to keep everything in play, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I can see where you're coming from, yeah. And we'll see. It's sort of funny, too. Like, you say, yeah, we don't hear from them for a month or 2 months. Usually, that would just be two issues of a comic, but because it's 52, that's eight issues right there, so.
Well, I mean, the best example I can think of that is the Space Heroes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they came back. That was back in issue, what, five and six?
I believe so. Yeah.
And nothing since. I mean, they're major story points that should have, I think, been covered by now. That, you know, we have, and I'm not even saying a full-blown scene on it or whatever, but background conversation on a radio or TV set or a newspaper headline or something to move those stories along.
When you say space heroes, I take it you mean the injured that arrived in Australia as opposed to Buddy Starfire and Adam.
Yeah,
Price,
yeah.
Right?
I mean, Hawkgirl, Alan Scott, Bumblebee,
sure.
Cyborg.
Yeah.
I will say, though, picking up on John's point, especially specific to, you know, the injured people that we, you know, we saw placed into that hospital, one of the things that I kind of like is that because the series works in real time weekly, I agree. Of course, I'd love to have more pages of it. I mean, you know, it's my favorite comic every week, so, you know, I wouldn't mind having more. But in that storyline, essentially, we see them all go into this hospital, and with the real time passing, when these characters return, you'll feel like, okay, they've actually taken the time to heal. I take your point that, I mean, it would be nice to fit in some passing reference, like you said, a news story or something like that. But when there's gaps, and then we pick up, like we did with the other space heroes, where they've got to fix a ship, and then we get back to them a month and a half later, and they've fixed the ship, you kind of feel like the time it takes to complete that task is earned, so that when we get those injured heroes back, it'll feel like, okay, they've been off the scene long enough that you kind of, it's legitimate that they've healed, as opposed to, say, Batman getting beaten near to death every night and he's kind of back the next day. I do sort of, you know, as much as I'll sometimes miss a story thread, I like the way that they can leverage those gaps as time has passed.
And I totally agree with that point. And I'm not saying they should, you know, either accelerate the healing or anything like that. But again, if there was at least a comment, you know, every other issue of, oh yeah, people are still over there, they're still working on this, that, or the other, they're still healing, whatever, that would be fine.
Yeah, but I think that makes sense. And I think that is one of the challenges that they face with the page space, is that we're kind of, with them having so many balls up in the air, I think we are, as readers, starting to wonder if things will get dropped or if they'll have enough space left. Like, that's one thing going forward that, you know, I also feel like the storytelling hasn't been rushed yet.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I think will be the challenge towards the end of the event, is will they have enough time in the issues they have left to keep the pace that they're at and finish all these stories, or will we see some either larger issues toward, you know, will the 52nd issue be 100 pages? You know, it'll be interesting to see if they've paced themselves correctly.
Well, we certainly won't get a 104 to sort of like tie up 52, so we're sort of going to have to do this. But, and just a reminder to everybody out there, as if you couldn't tell already, there will be plenty of spoilers in this episode 452. If we do any spoilers that are associated with 52, we'll make sure to mention it way ahead of time. But it's mostly going to be 52 spoilers here up to issue 22. So 23, you're in the clear. We're not going to be discussing that on the show because John still hasn't gotten it. He does DCBS. So we're just going to do up to issue 22. And for those who want an in-depth look at 52 issue number 1, back in the days when Toby was still the host, we actually had Sean Whalen and Jim Segulin on for a episode, I believe that was episode 5, if I remember correctly. It might have been even episode 3, I don't even know. It's so long ago, I can't even remember. But somewhere in our backlogs, we have the 52 wrap-up number 1, so you can listen to a full wrap-up of that. But we're certainly not going to go in-depth every single issue, or we'll be on for 22 hours. But let's talk a little bit about those heroes that actually are in the hospital, though, because I'm sort of surprised that Steel hasn't mentioned them at all, because about what John said about maybe even just like a single mention of them and just go on to with the rest of the story. I mean, it seemed that John Henry Irons was at least a bit concerned back in the early issues, but really hasn't shown much concern for his fallen heroes since.
I suppose, although they're in pretty good hands. You know, I mean, John Henry Irons has certainly had enough of his own stuff to worry about, and most of his story and attention is, you know, focused on his niece. But I at least, you know, again, I agree with John that it would be nice if there was even something along that news blotter, or, you know, a TV in the background where you see Dr. Midnight being interviewed or something. But I did get the impression from week 5 that they were left with some of the sort of best doctors of the DCU taking care of them.
I'm not trying to suggest they were in incapable hands. I certainly think that they're going to be well taken care of, but the one-year later titles gave us a certain set of expectations of where 52 ought to end up and what it needs to do during the course of it. And, you know, I feel that there's stories, or not even major events, but minor events, that should be happening that I don't think have.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you think they will happen then in the next couple of issues? I mean,
I don't know. I think in one or two cases, based on the implied timeline from some of the one-year later stuff, and again, I don't want to spoil any of that for anybody, that certain things should have happened by now.
Mm-hmm.
Both with those characters and in some cases with one or two others.
Yeah.
I mean, from my standpoint as a reader, I'm kind of going on two tracks with 52. One, reading it like a normal comic and just enjoying it. But two, also treating it like a mystery. Mm-hmm. We know certain things about, you know, again, where things have to land at the end, where things are when everything started out of, you know, Infinite Crisis and stuff. And trying to figure out how they're going to get there, when they're going to do certain things, and, you know, how certain aspects are going to resolve. And, you know, I'm using, you know, for my own, you know, stuff, what's happening in the one-year later titles as markers. It's like, well, this can't happen because, you know, such and such is going to happen or whatever. So with those expectations in mind, and you know the writers know all of this going forward.
Yeah.
Because they've had time to read some of the one-year laters, even if they didn't have any say over it, and I certainly would hope they'd had some say. I think, by and large, they're going to hit the major plot points they need to. They've done a well-researched, well-written story, but invariably, if something of this scope, which is going to be over 1,000 pages long when it's all said and done, stuff's going to fall through the cracks. There's no question about that.
Here's a good question. What format would you like to see them trade this once it's all said and done with? I mean, obviously, as you just mentioned, there'll be over 1,000 pages to work with. I mean, would you like to see some sort of absolute edition coming out of DC that has all 1,000 pages in it? Or would you rather see something about maybe, you know, four or five trades that sort of explain that? Because as DC's mentioned, they're not coming out with trades until 52 is entirely done. So we're not going to have to worry about this for a couple few months. But, I mean, David, since you've been so close with 52, I mean, would you yourself like to see an absolute edition come out?
I would certainly say God no, because with 1,000 pages, you would need a lectern in your home to read it. I mean, as a fellow New Yorker, most of my comics are read on the subway.
Yeah.
So, like, I've actually avoided a lot of hardcovers, and it's going to take me forever to get around to reading something like Lost Girls, because it's just too heavy to carry around.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
I would rather much more manageable trade, since I'm getting enough carpal tunnel just at my office job without having to sort of hoist a hardcover 1,000-page volume. So I'd say, I don't know, maybe if they break it into quarters or, you know, something. It would be nice if we end up, after the fact, noticing that there are act breaks. You know, I mean, we've sort of broken things down by month. I know that I often will look back on something a month at a time, you know, as we listen to the, you know, the TGS episodes on it as well. So it's easy to think of it as months. It would be interesting when we see the trades if there was actually an act structure that we didn't notice, you know, that was every 10 or 12 or so issues. I will say, in regard to the decision to not trade the event until it's done, I think that's great. I mean, that's one thing that I think that, you know, Dan DiDio said when this was all starting, that, you know, I think that that has really worked for me is that notion of reinvigorating the single issue, you know, giving you a reason to go to the shop every week if you're, you know, lucky enough to have a shop nearby. And I love that you've either sort of decided to take the plunge and commit to reading the novel a chapter at a time, or you're waiting until it's entirely done. And they've set it up in such a way that you can still enjoy the DC Universe 1 year later without having read it. But I think that there's a sort of, you know, fun, I don't know, nerdy brotherhood or whatnot between those that are tracking it. Just in the same way that the difference between the, you know, the people at the water cooler talking about Lost on a Thursday morning compared to those that wait for the whole DVD set to come out, you know, to get back to the TV comparison.
Well, I swear to God, if the polar bear shows up in 52, I'm done. I mean, John, obviously, I'm sure that your opinion is somewhat similar to his about the idea of that it's probably a good thing that they're waiting to trade on this, right?
Yeah, I'm surprised they are, to be honest, because trades usually help readers get up to speed and stuff. And with something that has so many issues like this, you know, they are making, you know, a calculated risk, you know, type choice here to do that. I think it's the right move. I think it definitely goes towards, you know, Dan Didio's clearly stated goal of focusing back on the monthly comics, like Dave said, getting people back into the store on a weekly basis. And it's doing, you know, a great job of that.
You are the numbers guy, and we do need to ask this at least once. How have the issues been doing on the charts?
Basically, with let me check something. Every issue has been 100,000 or over.
Wow.
I was thinking there was one that dipped below, but I think reorders pushed it above. And what was really interesting was it got a bump with issue 13 of about 17,000 copies, going from 102,400 copies with 12 to 119,300 copies with 13. Now, the reason that particular jump is interesting, the first 12 issues were returnable with certain restrictions, et cetera, because DC wanted to mitigate the risk to the retailers. I mean, ordering 12 issues sight unseen before, you know, you get any sense of if the readers are going to like this or hate it, you know, there's huge risk for the retailers there. So I had kind of been expecting that with issue 13, retailers would have seen how the first couple did, could react accordingly, gee, it's not returnable, be a bit more conservative. I thought it'd go down. So for it to jump up 17,000, I think is excellent.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah.
13, of course, was the first Batwoman issue, right?
Was that 13? Maybe I'm off by a month of my...
Actually, I have a lot 11. Of mine here. Let's
11.
See here.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, you're right. 11. Yeah,
yeah. 11 was the first Batwoman issue. 13, let's see, do I have it here?
That was the Resurrection.
There we go. Okay.
So that's great. So there, if I'm getting you right, John, so what you're saying is that once that returnable period went away and there were the new orders from 13 onward, rather than taking the opportunity to become more conservative, what the retailers had found is actually people are loving this and I'm going to start to order heavier.
Exactly.
Yeah, and the internet's played a lot into this as well. I mean, the fact that they put some of the issues for free on the internet, I'm sure certainly helps some people catch up with us.
I'll say, too, one thing that I really love about this title that I think is also brave on DC's part is that they have provided those issues for free, so somebody that wants to catch up, you know, has a way to sample it and then decide to jump in. But issues are not jump-on issues. You know that old adage that, oh, every issue is going to be somebody's first and every issue is going to be somebody's last, so you need to make a certain self-contained element to every issue. I love that they're not bothering to do that.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody chooses to just grab 23 off the shelf this week, they'll probably be pretty lost. I mean, they could go to the website. There's a great website to catch up, but they don't waste page space in making issue 23, let's say, accessible to a new reader at the loss of keeping all of the story threads going strong for the person that has, you know, committed 22 weeks up till then. And I think that's great. I mean, it reminds me of, you know, we keep making the television comparison. I think it's apt. To me, the best show on television right now is HBO's The Wire. It's incredibly dense, got huge ensemble casts, all sorts of story threads. It's, you know, it's very similar to 52 in that way. And if you jump into the middle of a season of The Wire, you're pretty lost. And it's because it's intended to be enjoyed the same way that you wouldn't jump into the middle of a novel. You know, it's very much a season is like a novel, and, you know, they're writing 52 the same way. So I like that they are, you know, they are making it something that you either commit to doing the whole thing or, you know, or not. But I think that allows so many plot threads to keep going strong.
I would agree with that, but I would also say, if you take a step back and look at the bigger picture, 52 is essentially potentially going to be an excellent jumping on point for readers. Because I suspect between the backup features with the history of the DC Universe and the origin stories, that everything you've got to know of who characters are, what some of the major backstory is and stuff, to really understand and appreciate 52 is going to be in the series in some way, shape, or form.
That's a good point.
Granted, I mean, you're going to get more if you've been reading DC for ages and stuff, but, you know, if again, take the series as a whole that way.
Yeah.
I think that's a fascinating decision.
I'm glad you mentioned the backup features, by the way, because we have had, you know, two distinct backup features in 52 so far. At first, the history of the DC Universe is told by Donna Troy, and now, sort of even further with the history of the DC Universe, we're getting individual characters' histories through Mark Waid and a rotating panel of artists, basically. Now, what have you guys thought of those backup features so far? I've heard different takes on this. I've heard some people feel it was really well suited for 52, and I've heard other people saying it should have been an outside series that was given more time to develop. Now, I sort of like it being in 52. I'm curious to see if maybe you guys are along the opinion of it belonging somewhere else.
Yeah, I do agree with you and John that it belonged exactly in 52. I mean, I think that it was going to be harder to be enjoyed by those of us that know the DC Universe well, because it is, you know, it is part of this, the grand tour of the DC Universe that 52 has been. So I think those backup features are meant to be friendly to a jumped on reader or a newer reader. I think that they could have been better. The DC Universe feature to me was pretty weak. Compared to, you know, and I recently came upon in a box the original history of the DC Universe that came out, I believe, after the last crisis, the first crisis, the Wolf and the Perez one. And what I think is a little stronger about this, of course, it's an outside thing, so it's got many more pages, but it's more of a guidebook. You know, it's objective camera. You know, there's just text narrating and images, as opposed to in 52, they tried to dress it up as a story. So we've got to watch Donna Troy watch these events, and you know they had so few pages to begin with that I didn't need Donna Troy. You know, plus there's something to me a little laughable about, okay, here's going to be this feature that's going to introduce you to the history of the DCU and make it all clear, and your host will be herself one of the most confusing characters in the entire DCU.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, that's almost self-parody. It's like, I'll be your host. I just expected her to turn to the little robot and be like, and Daddy, where did I come from? And that'd be the whole feature.
You know what I love about Donna Troy? I was reading about this actually on CBR's blog. They have Comic Book Urban Legends Revealed, and one of their earliest columns actually had, whether it was true or false, turned out to be true, that Wonder Girl ended up in the Teen Titans by mistake.
Yep.
Because there was a story about Wonder Woman, and I believe it was Wonder Tot and Wonder Girl, and they were all supposed to be younger versions of Wonder Woman. And one of the people involved with DC didn't realize that and thought that it was just, a sidekick for Wonder Woman. So all of a sudden, Wonder Girl shows up in the Teen Titans, and that's when her convoluted history began.
That's great. It's the stuff that must make editors drink, you know, because it's like one little mistake happens and you're stuck with it. You know, I mean, I don't want to digress too much, but, you know, this whole stuff about the changes that have been made to the Infinite Crisis hardcover and this and that, and essentially, you know, maybe we'll get into it later, but, you know, little changes that kind of leave a little more wiggle room for the future. I kind of understand it. You know, it's almost like a way in which, you know, the editors and Johns as a writer is saying, you know, I'm not going to screw that guy 10 years from now if I can help it. You know, maybe we can skip the next crisis by just leaving things a little more open, because especially now with the internet, they know we'll know. Like, we, you know, no mistake of theirs is not, you know, set down in stone to be thrown back in their face. So, you know, you can understand why they'd want to leave things a little more open.
Armageddon 2001.
I'm all for having wiggle room and stuff, but they should do it from the get-go, and you shouldn't have a, you know, Han shot first, you know, or not, you know, debate going on.
Well, you know, in a perfect world, yes, they would, but, you know, I take your point, of course, you know, but I would rather them, you know, if given the chance, to me at least, I would rather them fix it now than have to create an entire event to fix it 10 years from now.
Yeah, I actually am going to disagree on that.
Okay.
It's a recent enough story. They had enough lead time going into it. They've been saying, oh, we planned this for 3 years and stuff. I don't expect it to come out perfect, but to go and, you know, retool the story in the hardcover and stuff, I think that's cheating.
Well, I gotta say, though, and this is no ragging on Marvel whatsoever, but what we've been seeing with the continuity of 52 and, you know, the 1 year later and Infinite Crisis, that altogether has been a hell of a lot cleaner than anything we've seen out of Civil War. That much I'm saying. So, I mean, it's a hell of a lot easier to understand, you know, what's happening month to month and issue to issue and what's coming out of DC than it is Marvel right now. And at least they're doing that right.
I would agree with that, but I would like both companies to have tighter editorial control and just be able to keep track of where is each character, you know, in the overall, you know, universe and stuff, and at least get the broad brushstrokes right.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that at times they can't, and people's arms get unbroken, or somebody's gone, then they're back, then they're gone, then they're back, that just to me seems like a thing that, you know, the writers, the editors, somebody involved should catch.
Yeah.
Either that, or they should, you know, they should somehow outsource it to the fans. Clearly, we have the free time to track all this stuff. You know, just deputize us. Send us a little, like, deputy, you know, badge, and I'd do it.
Comic fans' lives? Nah.
Bunch of PDFs, you know. Anyway, getting back, and no, I, you know, I take your point. Getting back to the backup feature, just to finish on that. So yeah, to me at least, the history one was a little weak because, you know, we got to see some events and then we had to, like, watch Donna Troy cry about the events, and it was a little late. I think the Secret Origins have been really great. You know, I mean, I think they were different than what I expected. You know, back when this event was whole, you know, getting announced and described before Infinite Crisis, of course, was even done, I guess, I don't know about you guys, I was assuming that Infinite Crisis may end in a big reset button, you know, like the original
Crisis.
I was
expecting that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was thinking, oh, okay, well, these Secret Origins, like the original, well, not original, but the, I guess, most recent Secret Origins series, would be their chance to kind of reintroduce you to the characters and what changes they've made, things mm-hmm. like that. But so far, there's very little of that. It's pretty straightforward. It's pretty much, you know, again, perhaps for those new readers or those casual readers, it's the sort of click here content. It's like, oh, you want to know more about Metamorpho? Okay, well, here's two pages on where this guy came from. You know, and I've really enjoyed them. I mean, the mix of artists that they've had for it, you know, the conciseness. Every once in a while, you'll notice a little detail that they've changed, but for the most part, it's a pretty straightforward, and I think that it's, again, you know, as John said, I mean, as this being a big jumping on point for a new reader or to expand a reader's interest in DC, I think it's a great way to kind of expand the tour, you know, characters that you'll see for a moment, but, you know, here's where they came from.
Well, you know what I'm kind of surprised about, actually, just going back to the Donna Troy part of it a little bit, I'm actually surprised that Zero Hour still happened. Because I thought that if anything was going to happen out of Infinite Crisis, because they pretty much made this clear that Zero Hour, quote-unquote, happened because the continuity was not clear enough after Crisis on Infinite Earths and needed to be changed. Well, I'm kind of surprised that with the start of New Earth, there still was a Zero Hour. Now, I know that that would be taking away Parallax and all that, but I was sort of expecting that to sort of be pushed under the rug a little bit and not mentioned in the history.
I was not expecting it to go away at all. I think the main thing that DC has learned from both Crisis on Infinite Earths and Infinite Crisis, all the stuff in between, was if you've published it, you kind of sort of got to acknowledge it, whether you like it, hate it, whatever.
Yeah.
And the minute you start taking any one piece out in an interwoven continuity, everything potentially unravels. I mean, if you take out Zero Hour, you start undermining, you know, part of the JSA. You start undermining, you know, a couple other things here and there. I'd have
sure.
to actually
the launch of the launch of the Jack Knight Starman.
Yeah,
that meant Zero Hour. I'm not sure.
I think it was actually. Yeah.
I think so. I don't recall. I'd have to go reread Zero Hour to tell you else what else might get unraveled. But
yeah,
they seem to be spending so much time and effort, and rightfully so, putting things back in
mm-hmm.
that to selectively decide what to take out, I think, would be either, you know, hypocritical or just flat-out a mistake regardless.
Well, yeah, I mean, I like that when we got New Earth, the changes are really very slight.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it truly wasn't a reset. It was just a couple things offhand. What, the Wonder Woman was now a founding member of the Justice League.
Which was a reset to how it had been, so yeah.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, that's true. No, exactly, yeah.
Most of it was reassertions.
I forget the other one, but it was really small one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Batman's parents' killer was caught.
Oh, right. Yep.
Which actually is really big on him because, well, that explains why he is not nearly as paranoid as he once was because, well, he finally got that atonement, and yet he still, you know, still fights the good fight, which is exactly why
sure.
he's here.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it, you know, it allows him to be more of a hero because then what he does, is not a pathology. It's, you know, a choice to, you know, prevent other orphans from happening or whatnot. Yeah, I mean, it's a way to, it, you know, we got not a reset, but just a reinvigoration. And some of it was by inserting the stuff that used to not be broken, that once got fixed, that now we're going to go back to how we had it before.
Yeah. I'll admit, you know, when I go through previews, I don't read all of the stuff in depth, particularly on major things like 52. So I was expecting some very different stuff with the backup features. I was not expecting, you know, an art story, you know, with the Donna Troy crap like we got, which I was pretty much very disappointed with. I thought it was a horrible reuse of the History of the DC Universe title, which the Wolfman Perez stuff from way back was much better. I was actually expecting something more like a simple text piece like they had in, I think it was the Secret Files for the DC Universe, of, okay, 15 years ago this happened, 10 years ago this happened, and just kind of give us the broad brushstrokes of the timeline, you know.
Yeah.
I would have also preferred more of Who's Who style entries for character origins and stuff versus what we've got. What we've gotten is good, but as somebody who's been reading DC for like 20, 25 years, I'm more reading those things to find out, you know, what minor tweaks, what little spins have they put on things versus really getting anything new out of it. But in both cases, for new readers, I think they're essential backup features, and while they could have been better done, we're good to have.
Well,
and I wonder, too, is a new reader going to be invested enough that if they hit 2-3 pages of text at the end, are they going to read it? You know, if it's a picture of Metamorpho and then, you know, 5 paragraphs next to it, I wonder if they may be more apt to skip it than they will, you know, take the, you know, 2 minutes it'll take to get through those 2 pages.
And that's, you know, an excellent point. I would agree with that.
They've had one issue so far without any backup whatsoever, correct? It was only one so far.
They've had two. The first issue and 21.
Okay. All right.
Like, and they were able to get their pilot done with a little extra page space, and then once the storylines were running, they could start to give some pages up to the backups.
Okay. All right. Yeah, and the backups are just that. They're backups. You know, if you want to read them, you want to read them. But if you don't read them, you're not going to get lost. And that's exactly what they're there for. Speaking of surprises, as John was talking about a bit of a surprise of what happened with the backups themselves, what have your biggest surprises been in 52, story element-wise? I mean, what just absolutely floored you so far about 52 when you go in there and read it? I mean, David, I'm curious. Let's start with you. What has your biggest shock been so far?
Sure. I'd say probably my, you know, and it's a recent one, but I'd say that the Skeets revelation was just great. I mean, it was just never, not one that, you know, absolutely didn't see coming, was a great shock value moment. I think especially because it you know, it put a twist on a character that, you know, because he's sort of something of a, you know, he's comic relief, so I think that, you know, when you have a clown character like that, you know, that you've known for all these years, you don't expect there to be anything more to him. So the notion that there could be something else going on with his character, particularly what we saw happen, which we don't quite know what it means yet, but that to me was just such a great and unexpected surprise. Probably my favorite so far.
Yeah. I mean, I hear Billy West's voice in my head whenever I would see Skeets, you know, on the page because of Justice League Unlimited, because I felt that voice was just absolutely perfect for it. Now I'm thinking a bit differently about my choice of voices because, well, this might be a more maniacal character than I ever thought.
You know, it's a great little detail, and I'll admit I didn't notice this myself, but it was pointed out by people on the forum. His voice changes in that moment because the word balloon that he speaks with changes.
Mm.
So, you know, usually Skeets has that sort of boxy, radio-looking voice that we, of course, read, you know, in our ear, we hear it as sort of a computer or artificial voice. And I believe, I don't have the issue to dig out in front of me, but I believe when he switches to that line, he knows. I think it's just a straight dialogue balloon. So it's almost like he drops the fake Skeets affectation and, you know, it speaks with a different voice. And it's great because it's, you know, how often in comics do you even really, you know, think of the voice unless there's, you know, something really particular done to the word balloon. So I thought that was a nice little twist on just a you know, huge beat change, you know, some mask or disguise dropping. So it might have been the Billy West voice and then who knows what voice that other one was.
Hey, I mean, that's actually a really nice touch. You know what? I didn't even pick that up the first time that I read it. So I'm glad that you've actually pointed that out, because now I'm going to have to look back and see whether or not it's as, you know, jarring a change as you say it is. Because, well, it, you know, if it went by me, I'm going to have to go back and read it. So
I'm flipping through that now. And basically, they usually do his dialogue balloons with little jagged lines as if it's like a technical broadcast kind of a thing. And for that one dialogue balloon, yeah, it drops to just a normal... but that could just be as easy as he didn't broadcast that to, I guess that's Daniel Carter.
Yeah.
So it may not be that his voice changed, just that that was more he's talking to himself. Not saying that is what it is, but just, you know...
That's true. I mean, I suppose it, you know, it could be the difference between a broadcast and a whisper, but it's still a great effect. I mean, it's almost like, you know, and I suppose it's, you know, I'm just used to, you know, as an actor, I tend to read flat text in my mind with a voice to it, or with, you know, because I'm just used to acting play scripts and things like that. But, you know, so to me, it's great when I reread it that, you know, it just suddenly stood out as such a different voice, whether it's an aside or whether it's a whisper, or, you know, to me, it's just sinister that there's something about that change from his little robot boxy thing to just such a straight on line, he knows.
Well, and again, it's such a subtle effect.
Yeah. And it also makes me think whether or not he's being controlled by somebody, or whether or not that this is, you know, just him finally revealing his true self. Because I wouldn't be very surprised if, you know, there is some villain somewhere, either in Booster's own time or possibly, you know, somewhere outside of time that might very well be controlling him right now. I'm thinking, and this might be completely out of left field, people might not agree with this at all, I'm thinking it might very well have something to do with the monitors.
It could, but I don't think so.
Okay.
My favorite crackpot theory, and of course, as we keep comparing to television, I would say just like the best way to enjoy Lost is to try to formulate crackpot theories and guesses as to what things mean, where things are going. I think that's essential to enjoying 52, is to have your crackpot theories. My favorite Skeets one, that I think it was Rainbow Cloak from the CGS forum brought up, that I think is great, is that, speaking of villains hiding in plain sight, that it could be Max Lord. You know, we have Max Lord, who had a telepathy sort of mind control power with organisms, but then later in his history got a cyborg body, which I believe was still the body he had when he was killed in Countdown to Infinite Crisis, or Infinite Crisis 1, or wherever the heck it was that he, Wonder Woman snapped his neck. Could he have done a jump into Skeets?
I forget
if Skeets is present in that scene, but I know that they've always had a connection. You know, there's all this network stuff with the OMAX. I feel like Max Lord was such a big villain reveal that they couldn't possibly be done with him already.
But isn't Skeets disabled at that point?
I don't remember.
Potentially a previous version of Skeets, too. This version came back with Booster in, I think, Infinite Crisis.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Had different tail fins, whatever.
And I forgot an essential part of it. Remember when the first time that there was a blip where Skeets was wrong about his future history, he powered off, and then Booster brings him to Will Magnus, and he kind of powers back on, and he makes that comment about, oh, he's really zen to be deactivated, the internet should do it once a week. That could be a chance if, let's say, Max Lord as sort of a presence, and we've had all these stories throughout 52 about the notion of artificial souls, like with the Metal Man and, you know, things like that. Could Max Lord or somebody have used the opportunity of that Skeets going offline to sort of jump in and start?
I certainly think that's a key opportunity, and something happened at that point. Mm. And it could be, like you said, Max Lord. It could be some version of a Brainiac. My crackpot theory, which I would be amazed if it was true, but I think would be funny, is I think it's Quizlet's twin, you know, evil twin brother.
Say it again, who?
Quizlet from the Legion of Superheroes.
Oh.
He was a little energy thing that flew around in a ship very similar to Skeets.
Oh.
No, in hell that's going to be it. But.
But that's half the fun. I mean, you know, and there's a chance. I mean, heck, look at some of the characters that have been getting pulled into this event. I mean, there is really a sense of the entire toy box of the DCU being up for grabs.
Yeah,
sure. In a way that is so often not the case in a regular book. I mean, that's one thing that I really love about this. I mean, it's got an ensemble of characters that are the sort of the leads, but the star is the DCU itself. So, it, you know, there's that sense of, you know, like whoever thought Lobo would come back in the middle of an event in 2006. You know, there's just people that keep getting pulled in that you just kind of figured had fallen so far to the bottom of the toy box, to beat that metaphor to death, that they'd never come up again. So I think, yeah, could be anything or, you know, anyone. But
Ambush Bug coming soon.
I hope so.
Exactly. You know, the what was it, all those pallbearers at Booster's funeral. I mean, there's just, you know, ways in which, and I think a lot of that is the strength of having a writing team. You know, you have these four writers who have not only probably their own list of favorites, but different eras of the DCU that they like. You know, you've got such a wealth of trivia and knowledge and love of different characters and different corners of the DCU in that writing room that, you know, who knows who else we'll see before it's done.
Yeah, I have been amazed at who's been, you know, pulled from the obscure pages of, you know, who's who, if they even made it in there.
John, what's been your most shocking moment of 52 so far?
I would actually probably go with the death of Booster Gold.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of, you know, not horribly surprised by Skeets, because I thought they'd set the scene of something was happening with him. I don't think we're done with Booster Gold. I'm a little confused as to which Booster Gold this may or may not have been, what's going on with Daniel, that sort of a thing. But that was the one event that it's like, okay, I didn't really see that coming. I'm surprised they went this direction. I want to see where they're going. The other thing I would say would be just the whole Supernova mystery and where they're going with that. That's the one I enjoy speculating about the most.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, speaking about Booster Gold, have either of you read Justice League of America number 2?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, then I'm gonna warn people that I'm gonna give away a spoiler here, because very quickly in Justice League of America number 2, Booster Gold's name is mentioned. And they mention that he's dead. You know, how is he possibly going to be a member of the team? And they say, I say we should honor him by putting somebody in the suit. Mm. Now, that makes me think, well, obviously, Daniel's got to come back eventually. Because, well, that suit is kind of outside of time right now. So we certainly haven't seen the last of Booster Gold.
Well, there's no question we haven't seen the last of Daniel. Because, I mean, Rip Hunter and a few other time things have been mentioned. I don't think we can go through this entire series without some sort of time travel aspect to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me,
Do we have time for a quick other crackpot theory?
Go ahead.
Okay, it's my favorite. It's the one, because it's the one that I feel like I've come up with more by myself than most of the other ones.
Well, I think I know what you're about to say.
Okay, and I've been beating the board to death with it for months now, but I'm still holding on to it. The whole Daniel Carter thing was like, it made me worried. It's like, oh, maybe this isn't going to work out, but I still have hope. So my thought with Booster, and when I was rereading some of the earlier issues, such as when the Booster in 52 appears, it, to me, it really reinforces it. I feel like who will get back at some point in the event, and I don't know if he'll still live to the end, but to me, the Booster that we got after Crisis on Infinite Earths, what I sort of refer to as the Dan Jurgens Booster from his own series and Justice League International, the one that, you know, matured, made it through Crisis on Infinite Earths, helped with the attack on the OMAC satellite, and then seemed to leave in disgust or sadness or whatever you want to call it during Infinite Crisis, I'm waiting for him to come back, because I feel like the Booster that we got at 52 is, and this is, of course, where time travel stuff always is a headache, it's a new Booster coming back for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
That this is somebody who he's fresh from the 25th century, and why time is broken, as is spelled out on Rip Hunter's board, is that for whatever reason, whether it's Skeet's evil plan or his own idea, he decided that better than what the history books, you know, were say that Booster's supposed to appear in, you know, 1986 or whatnot, that wouldn't it be a better place to go to the year without Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman? This year in which power and superheroics were truly up for grabs, and I'm going to go be the hero of Metropolis by, you know, arming myself with all this knowledge and going to that year. So he picks, you know, he basically plays against his own fate. And the Booster that we've seen that dies in 52 is a very young, new one. Because that's how that character reads. I mean, that's, you know, I was really disappointed in the early issues of 52 that it seemed like Booster had regressed so much. because I felt like in Infinite Crisis, after Ted got killed, we finally saw a Booster that kind of matured.
Yeah.
You know, that seemed to be standing shoulder to shoulder with those other heroes when they lead the attack on the satellite. And this new one, it just, you know, it doesn't read to me that in his grief he would suddenly regress back to being so shallow. And a lot of his scenes with people that Booster would know, you kind of watch the 52 Booster sweat through it. You know, you kind of watch him bluff, and there's that scene with Ralph where Ralph is asking why he didn't warn him about what was going to happen to Sue, and he kind of gives some lame answers, and then you see him kind of be relieved when the conversation is done. So it just feels like Skeets is feeding him information because he's an even bigger fraud than the original Booster was when he started out. So my hope is that the Booster that died was, you know, a different one that was starting out again, and then the mature Booster will be the one that we get back. I wonder even if there's a chance that he's the one that's in the supernova suit.
I was just going to say that, yeah.
You know, the Jurgens Booster, the mature one, can go to the future, load up on new tech, and that scene where you see Supernova and Booster fight, Supernova's dialogue in that, Supernova's usually very aloof. And in that dialogue, it's really personal in that fight. I mean, he says things to Booster, and these aren't going to be direct quotes, but something like, well, you were always like that, weren't you? You know, you would have to make a choice, and you never do that, do you? There's all of this sort of berating stuff between them that, to me, reads like a man facing the younger version of himself that he's ashamed of. That's my favorite crackpot theory. May not still work out, but I hold on to hope. I think that might still be what we're seeing. And, of course, I want to believe it because I'd like to get the old Booster back.
Yeah. Well, along with that, I actually have the theory that the Booster that died is actually New Earth Booster. Not only just, you know, a Booster back in time, but this is the New Earth version of Booster. Now, the Booster that might very well be Supernova, might very well still be around, that Booster survived the whole, you know, forming of New Earth because of, you know, either being out of time at the time or something along the lines of that, and that sort of breaks time. You know, the reason why there's two Boosters going around, because this is a Booster before New Earth formed and a Booster after New Earth formed, and that explains it to me.
Could be, yeah. I mean, and I think that speaks to how fun some of the messy parts of continuity and the great parts of continuity are being leveraged as positives.
Yeah.
In 52, is that, you know, it really, you know, the fact that there's been these changes and there's time travel and there's magic and there's life after death and all that stuff kind of, from a narrative point of view, puts all of that into the realm of the possible. So,
yeah,
and again, similar to Lost, it's like we don't quite know what the rules of the place that they're living are, and are they like our own rules? So the world that they're in is one in which any of this stuff is possible.
Yeah, it means that any theory is not too far-fetched.
Exactly.
That's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what makes it so much fun. And to go with my shocking moment, I'd say my most shocking moment of 52 so far would be, and also the freakiest moment, the Straw Sue. When she's crawling over to Ralph and, you know, says his name, I'm just, oh my God, this is really, really freaky. Like, I mean, this was a complete different 52 here. We had not seen anything along the lines of something this creepy or this insane since the thing started. And that just shows, you know, how many shocks we're going to get in this series, because had you told me when this thing started that eventually we'd have a, you know, a reanimated Sue or something along those lines, you know, crawl over to Ralph and cause him to have a nervous breakdown, I would have said, well, you're sort of a bit too much on the crackpot theories there. This is never going to happen. But I'm thinking, even to this point, that wasn't, you know, a reanimated Sue, that somewhere in that room, somebody was manipulating that with their abilities, with their powers. Because, that makes a lot more sense to me.
I would agree with that. And the name Dev M, who's the leader of that cult, or at least that part of the cult, is a character, you know, pre-Crisis and stuff, from Legion of Superheroes.
Okay.
He was a Kryptonian who later became a Daxamite when, you know, various backstory things shifted, whatever. So that character, I think, is going to come back and play some kind of a role in it. Do I think he necessarily is Kryptonian Daxamite? No. My crackpot theory, which I know is probably never going to come to pass, I think it's Danny Chase.
Okay.
Because you've got a guy who, from, you know, the background or whatever, is basically playing puppet master, animating corpses, you know, making people think they hear stuff, you know, whatever, something along those lines. clearly somebody is pulling Ralph's strings, both with that and with some of the stuff later on. And the question is, who's doing it and why? And what are they after?
That's a good question to ask.
Yeah, and that issue, which I think it's appropriate that was the 13th issue as well, was, it was really grim. My thought on that scene when I reread it was also that Ralph is the only one that sees the straw effigy body thing move and speak. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if, I mean, Ralph has become something of your classic unreliable narrator. And so I find myself questioning just about anything that Ralph sees when no one else sees it, particularly after that issue, the one that Shadow Pact was in later on, in which he hears the helmet talking to him and nobody else hears the helmet speak at all. So
that could be
magic, or that could be that Ralph is on a journey that is partly in his own head. So it's tough to say. I know when I read that issue 13, I didn't think that. You know, it was just a shocking moment. I thought, my God, what made that effigy move, and isn't that horrible for Ralph? But then after that moment with the Fate Helmet, I started to think, well, I wonder if he was already broken enough that he's desperately starting to see things that aren't there.
I think he's seeing stuff, he's hearing stuff, but nobody else is. I think it's, be it, telepathy or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
If it's in Ralph's head, somebody's putting it there.
Okay.
Mm.
Oh,
sorry, and one last thing. And there is somebody that has been pointed out that's standing, like, in shadow behind Ralph in the last panel of 13.
Yeah.
With a hat and a coat. I don't know if it's Phantom Stranger, or it could be somebody, could be the person that you mentioned, John. But there is a chance that there's certainly somebody even physically behind Ralph's scene.
You guys know who Danny Chase is, right?
I don't.
He was in the New Teen Titans for a while. He was a young kid who was basically a telekinetic. Nobody liked him. They killed him off at one point, and he became, a phantasm or whatever at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And basically he was animating a cloak, a mask, and a pair of gloves. And, hiding in the background the whole time sort of thing.
Yeah.
Huh.
In Teen Titans Volume 3, Number 39, Zatara mentions that he and Kid Devil went on a trip to New Azeroth, where they were almost eaten by Phantasm.
Mm-hmm.
So he definitely is around.
Hmm.
I think Phantasm later became something more than just Danny Chase with the whole New Azeroth stuff, but it's been a while since I've read some of that. So,
pretty good.
That's possible,
My quick Danny Chase question, most importantly, when they killed him, did they rip off his head or limbs?
I think the fan base would have been much happier if they did. He was a much hated character.
You don't really die like a Titan unless you get your head or limbs ripped off.
That's true.
That's sort of the new standard of Titan death. So
the first time he died, he quote unquote died off camera, so he was able to pose as dead and do this stuff. The other time, he was pretty clearly, no longer in the game. I forget exactly what happened though.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm curious to see if the White Martians have anything to do with the fact that Elongated Man is seeing these things in his head, because we do see, and again, this is a bit of a spoiler here for Teen Titans, so anybody who hasn't read Teen Titans, you might want to skip over this part here, but we see a White Martian in the form of, I believe it was Miss Marvel is her name, Martian Manhunter...
Miss Martian.
Miss Martian, there you go, Miss Martian.
That would be hilarious. Looking for trouble.
Oh, exactly, yeah. Now, Miss Martian is a White Martian. And I would not be surprised if the White Martians have something to do with this, because, or better yet, even the guy in the guy in the trench coat and the hat, it could be Martian Manhunter for all we know, because he's had attire like that in the past when he's gone into human form, perhaps he's going in there to, because he's been alone in his life many a time, so who better to try and console somebody who's been alone in their life? Like Ralph is feeling right now, than the Martian Manhunter who lost his family the way that he did.
That's great, yeah. Especially because there's no reason why I don't think anything in that first, I only read the first one, but that first 1 year later Martian Manhunter issue, I don't think indicated that he was gone that whole year.
Yeah.
So there's no reason why he shouldn't, play into 52 somewhere. So that's a good guess.
Be nice to see him at least.
That's actually a very scary theory, because think it through from the Martian Manhunter's perspective. He's essentially trying to make it look like Sue gets resurrected. That falls through.
Yeah.
Suppose it didn't fall through, though. Then the theory would be that what? The Martian Manhunter would be invisible and tangible, take over Sue's form, kind of appear where the dummy was, and then pose as Sue for a while?
Ooh.
Jeez.
I mean, that has really bizarre relationship issues with Ralph there.
There's an element of role-playing to that I don't think we want to explore.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't thinking about the whole reanimate the effigy corpse straw thing. I was only thinking of him being that guy that's in the shadow watching over Ralph. So
yeah, I mean, I'm thinking it might be a white Martian that reanimated him, but that it's a Martian that Martian Manhunter is looking over him. So that's the green and the white Martians right there.
I want to take a moment to just sort of self-consciously say that if somebody were to, I know it's not radio, it's podcasting, so you can't tune into the middle, but could you imagine tuning into the middle of this conversation? Like, well, it could be the white Martian. It just sounds like it's exactly paranoid schizophrenics being like, well, who could be controlling our friend? It could be the white Martian. No, well, there was this kid that was a pair of gloves in a... Anyway, so I had
and somebody's planting these images in his mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Scary thought.
Well, what's great, though, I mean, it is such a rich tapestry of characters and strange powers and things like that that, you know, it allows all of these sort of, you know, it kind of allows all these delusional-sounding theories. But sorry, anyway, go on.
But that's part of what makes it such a great series, though, is it gives so much room for things to speculate on. It gives you some additional clues every so often. And it gives people stuff to talk about. And between that and the weekly pace, I mean, it's really doing a great job bringing people back to the stores and getting them engaged in the storyline.
Oh, definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I know of a lot of people, actually, that have come back to the stores because of 52.
And it's turned me into a much bigger DC fan. I mean, part of why I'm not recognizing a lot of these characters that you guys are, like, pulling out of your hat is that, I mean, I wasn't, you know, I as a kid, I was a Marvel kid. I mean, I read, you know, Batman, and I read the Giffen DeMatteis Justice League and a few of the tie-ins, but I don't know much of the DC universe. And this has not only reinvigorated, but expanded my interest in, you know, all of these characters and the history and the stuff that I don't know. So I feel like, I mean, I'm certainly not, you know, a new reader to it, but I've read a lot more DC in the last few years than I ever had before. So that notion of this grand tour and characters that have popped up and, you know, old Silver Age mad scientists and all that stuff is new to me and great. You know, like I think that it's a way to take somebody like me who got turned on to more DC books, you know, in the last maybe 4 years or 5 years and make me into a bigger DC fan. And I think it's working. I mean, I think that it's it's creating a lot of excitement on their side of the big two.
Well, I mean, I've been reading DC Comics since before Crisis on Infinite Earths, and I've probably read, you know, 95% of what's come out since Crisis. And what I'm really enjoying now, both between 52 and 1 year later, is there's a sense of rediscovery, new ground to go explore and stuff.
Yeah.
And it really, you know, re-engages me as a reader. It's just a lot of fun.
And it sounds like it rewards you for the reading you've done. You know, when you can recognize
totally.
A few jumps ahead of a reader like me, it's because it's rewarding you for the time that you've put into, you know, getting to know this fictional place. You know, you are somebody that kind of knows the lay of it better than somebody that's new.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. And having people like Mark Waid as one of the writers who is, you know, a walking encyclopedia of DC, you know, history and knowledge means that they can toss little things, you know, into a page that some people, you know, wouldn't even notice. That I'm thinking, oh, wait, that implies this, that, or the other.
Yeah. Hey, well, you know what? The reason why he's doing those two-page histories of all the characters is because he doesn't have to look these characters up. He knows all this information off the top of his head.
And I think not only do we get, you know, such a rich, you know, taste and knowledges and things like that out of the writing room, but I think it's also really helped the storytelling that, you know, you essentially have an ensemble of six main characters, three of which are detectives. So, you know, instead of a story where all of your leads are, you know, action heroes and, you know, leading man types, we've got kind of a cast of, you know, more of your observers or investigators. So, you know, if half the cast are detectives, then, you know, we're going to follow them through, you know, whether it be Ralph's magical investigations or question of Montoya's sort of geopolitical from the streets to the Middle East exploration. You know, it gives us a way to follow the characters on that journey and be taken on a tour all through the DCU.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Would it feel nearly as much like a weekly TV show if there weren't this many detectives involved? Because I feel like, you know, it's almost like the same sort of thing, like almost like a Law and Order type thing. Whenever I see Renee Montoya in the question, I get that feel of almost like a CSI or a Law and Order type situation, because they just have that feel to the characters right there. And there's always some sort of mystery involved. And that just keeps me coming back every single week.
The TV show I would say this equates most to for me is Babylon 5.
Okay.
Because you've got big overarching stories, a lot of character threads, a lot of lines that initially seem like throwaway lines that I don't think are, and a lot of things, particularly at the end of issues and whatnot, of either revelations or new questions being asked. Again, things to speculate on, and that's one of the things I thought Babylon 5 did brilliantly. And 52 is doing a great job on.
I've never watched Babylon 5. I one thing I do know of it, though, that I can see where this comparison comes is in a past life for a magazine, I actually interviewed Straczynski when Babylon 5 was first starting, and I was really impressed by the fact that he had that five-year plan.
Yeah.
That he went into this, and, you know, to me, I looked at it and went, wow, this is really, you've engineered a cult hit right out of the gate because you've done the work to, you know, track this whole storyline. You have this big arc that you're telling, and I can see why any Babylon 5 fan I meet loves it, you know, and to them it is better than Star Trek, it's better than so many other things, because they felt so satisfied at the end of it by that grand plan. I think in 52 we also get the benefit of that, because they, you know, you have this gear that's been removed from continuity, and you've had a writer's room that have threaded and broke the storyline, you know, to the end. You know, you can have things like Rip Hunter's board teasing details. You can have things that get planted at the beginning and paid off later, because unlike, to me, I guess, any 52 issues of a series, I mean, maybe Cerebus is an exception, I don't know, but, you know, I can't think of any other series that had 52 issues where all 52 felt like they were one big plan. I mean, maybe Why the Last Man will work out to be that way, but, you know, but even Vaughn has admitted that he's changed things throughout the way. In this instance, they've locked and committed themselves like you'd write a novel, you know, that you have an ending that you're working towards, and you break it down and you work through it. I mean, it's like, you know, again, a well-planned season of a TV show, only our season we get 52 episodes.
Well, the term I always like to use with Babylon 5 that I think applies to 52 is kind of premeditated storytelling. They're not winging it. They know where they're going.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff, I think, in 52, very subtle seeds were planted as far back as Infinite Crisis and Previous.
Oh, sure.
I think the coming of Supernova was a seed planted in Infinite Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And what's brave about that is, in having to plan so much out ahead, is they have to make decisions about what we as the readers are going to like and respond to ahead of time. You know, if you took 52 issues of, you know, the X-Men or something, it could be that when they introduced, I don't know, Gambit, they didn't really think he was going to be all that much. And then they got all these, so suddenly we have all this Gambit stuff. You know, they've locked themselves into something that can't actually be changed too much by what they hear back from people. You know, they kind of make some choices and commit to them and stick with them. It could be that, you know, I don't think this is the case, but what if all of us were kind of bored with Supernova? We're like, I don't care.
Exactly.
That mask.
Yeah.
They'd already committed to that being a central, perhaps the central mystery of 52, and they had to do it right.
Yeah, because 52 is not getting canceled.
Yeah, exactly. And they couldn't read the mail and be like, okay, let's push that to the back and let's move this thing up front. Oh, the guy with the claws, everybody loves him. Okay, let's, you know, have him be central in the next. You know, they have to kind of follow through with what they plan. So as a premeditated story, you know, each and every, and also unlike, let's say, Law and Order, there's no disposable episode. You know, Law and Order has run for 17 years now as a creaky old machine, because, you know, the detectives are kind of interchangeable, and it's all about the, you know, vaguely beautiful, ready-for-television murderer of the week. So you can repeat that, whereas, and I'd assume this is true of Babylon 5 also, you know, you couldn't have just an average, throwaway, disposable episode. Everything needed to push you towards that completion point.
Sure, yeah.
You can, but they damn well better be few and far between.
Damn straight.
Because they had a few in Babylon 5.
Just, week.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, I actually want to touch on two of the main questions here, because we've talked about Supernova. I gave my idea of who he might be. We haven't really given the idea of who you guys think is underneath the Supernova outfit. But I also want to touch at the same time, because this has something to do with Metropolis as well, about Luthor's Justice League. Now we know what they're actually going to be called, Infinity Inc. Now, it's sort of interesting to me that Luthor is sort of trying to get himself back in the public eye by getting this to happen, you know, trying to make people believe that he's not nearly as bad a guy as he is, while we all know that he's pulling the strings here. I mean, it's very, very obvious from the death of the Speedster that he can turn off their powers with the flick of a switch, and then there's one dead hero on your hands. Whatever he wants, he can get here. But the one thing he can't get is superpowers out of it, which is the most interesting aspect of it. And Let me get your idea of who you think is behind the Supernova mask, and then let me get your idea behind where you think this whole Infinity Inc. thing is going
to
go.
Who would you like to start?
Let's go with John.
Okay, with Supernova, I've had, you know, every time I look at it, another idea pops to mind kind of thing. The biggest problem I've seen with almost all of my theories is it almost always comes down to a white Caucasian male, you know, guy kind of thing. It's like, you know, they're going diverse. I doubt they're going to go that way. It could be an alternate Booster Gold. It could be an alternate Ted Kord. Prior to some of the recent stuff about Lex Luthor not getting powers, I was thinking he was a choice. I still think Alex Luthor is a choice. I've heard Rip Hunter and the Eradicator bandied about. Same with Ambush Bug. The theory I favor, and I think there's no chance in hell it'll happen, is I think it's somebody somehow connected to the Earth One Superwoman from the DC Comics Presents annuals. I guess it was 2 and 4, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Which was basically a lady who came back in time from the mid-25th century or somewhere to figure out who Superwoman was, and then discovered she was Superwoman and mimicked all the powers with technology. She had powers of flight, essentially teleportation. She could mimic super strength. She could disintegrate things. Maybe have one or two other powers, which are all very, very similar to what Supernova has exhibited. So, I mean, obviously, I don't think it's the Earth One Superwoman, because, you know, guy, girl, you know, obvious, you know, physical differences, whatever.
Yeah.
It worked for Ronan.
You just had to mention Ronan, thanks.
And virtually every Shakespeare comedy, you know, they always... Sorry, go ahead.
That's true. But again, they've shown enough pulling obscure stuff, you know, from the past into play that I'm not going to rule that theory out. And that's really both the most esoteric one I've come up with and the one I kind of like the best. What was the other question you had?
About Infinity Inc. I mean, do you think that, where do you think this is going to go here? I mean, do you think we might still actually get some of these guys as heroes when 52 is done with, or are they all doomed for failure because they're associated with Lex?
I think they're doomed for failure. I think reusing the name wasn't terribly surprising, but I'm not terribly thrilled with it. I like the old Infinity Inc. stuff. I'm curious about this new Nuklon, because he seems to have the same powers and whatnot as the old one, but it's clearly a different character. I would expect what's going to come out of this is potentially a new Infinity Inc. series, miniseries, whatever, or at least team, that takes maybe two or three of these characters, takes a couple of the old school ones, maybe, you know, Brainwave Jr., maybe a few others that aren't in use, although I'm having a hard time thinking of any that aren't in use that would be worth bringing back, and mixing them together. I mean, we know this is going to all end badly, both for the team and for Luthor, because that's just how things work out for him.
Yeah.
But and they again, may salvage one or two.
Yeah, and again, he can't have powers. That's the best thing about this, because, you know, he's always wanted to be this all-powerful guy, and the few times that he's gotten powers, it's either given him cancer or he's gotten screwed out of it.
But also, with my theory of Supernova, I don't think Supernova has powers. I think Supernova has a suit that has powers.
Okay. Well, it's obviously not Lex, that much I know, but it would certainly be interesting if they do turn out to be Lex, because they'd have a lot of explanation to do there, but he could be simulating powers, because, well, obviously the suit does do something. Now, David, with you, give me your theory on Supernova, and give me your take on Infinity Inc.
Sure. And I've also heard a lot of great theories on Supernova. Ping had one about regarding Starman 1 million, and of course 1 million appears on a booster cover. Daniel Carter got sent to, of course he got sent to year 1 million, which I know is different than the year that DC 1 million takes place in, but you know, that's a bit in the air. He also pointed out, and it's one of those things that's so simple, it's in front of you that you miss it, what happens when a star blows up?
Supernova.
Supernova. So there's something, you know, but the only, the reason why I'm going to go back to, you know, as compelling of an example as that one was, the reason I'm going to go back to my I hope it's the Juergens booster in the supernova suit idea is that I feel like to make 52 satisfying as its own novel, Supernova has to be connected to someone or something that we've seen in the pages of 52. You know, for the person who is this person we've been describing that's the new reader or the jumped-on reader that's, you know, got turned on to DC, let's say, in Infinite Crisis, and they stuck through 52, if Supernova takes that mask off and the reaction is, who? Like, I'm the superwoman of the, you know, annual, or I'm Starman of 1 million, or I'm anybody who has not directly or ancestrally connected with 52, it'll be unsatisfying. I just feel, you know, it's that whole thing of, you know, you lay something and you pay it off later. I just feel like there's got to be some connection between Supernova and characters that we know in 52. Now, if he's connected with Superman in some way or with Krypton in some way, well, okay, I guess everybody knows Superman, so, you know, we could connect that in. But, yeah, I just, so my hope is that it'll be that booster reveal, because I also agree that I think it's a superpowered suit. I feel like there was something really personal in that fight with the younger booster. I'm gonna stand by that one. I'm gonna stake my bet on that one. Just because I also think it would be a satisfying payoff in the sort of in the novel of 52. So
okay,
we'll see how that one goes.
I would agree with that. It's just for me an issue of working out how the timeline of events would happen to make that possible.
Sure. You know, my hope is that, you know, the Juergens booster goes away after the events of Infinite Crisis. I don't know why he picks the time he does. I mean, maybe to counter his own younger self. I mean, maybe it's sort of like, you know, again, looking at historical records or whatever, when he realizes that his own self has, with Eskete, done the thing that he was supposed to do in that museum in the 25th century, but he picked the wrong spot or something. It's almost like Supernova Booster goes there to kind of block too much harm by his own self. I don't know. But there's also been a lot of really baffling Supernova scenes, like that scene he has in the cave, looking at that Infinity Gauntlet looking thing. I don't know what to make of that, other than Supernova knows where the cave is. He likes to give lingering looks to the empty dead Robin costume. I don't know what that means. So I'm going to still hold on to the booster one, but, you know, we'll see how it goes. But I do think it's going to be, it can't end up being someone too obscure or too rooted in continuity that's more than 5 years old. But
wouldn't it be something if it turns out to be Earth 2 Robin?
Whatever Earth 2 Robin did we get in Infinite Crisis? Did we get anything of him?
We got a vision of him, but I don't think we actually saw him.
Yeah, we didn't get him, but if I remember correctly about Crisis on Infinite Earths, didn't him and Earth 2 Huntress just basically just walk off into nowhere and we never saw them again?
No, they got killed.
They did get killed?
Okay. In the final few issues, they got crushed by rocks, nobody was found, or...
Well, again, nobody was found.
Yeah.
That's the thing, though. So it could be him. If it is, I mean, it would be a real shock to me that they actually pull something like that. But hey, the lingering look at the Batman costume could have something to do with that.
But it also goes go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. And you probably were about to say the exact same thing. Remember that scene in, what was it, Infinite Crisis 2, with the confrontation between Superman of Earth 2 and Batman, where the big emotional question is, on your world, what happens to Dick Grayson? He's dead, or I forget what the answer is.
Is he a better man on your world?
Is he a better man? So there was a big sort of heavy-handed reference to Robin of Earth 2 in Infinite Crisis.
Yeah.
Although, again, I just, you know, there's been no hint of it now at the nearly halfway point of 52. I also feel like if he took that mask off and he's like, I'm Robin of Earth 2, to the newer reader, there'll just be a big, what? You know, like,
exactly.
It would be a moment that would represent everything that one fears about committing oneself to a comic book universe. Like, what you never want is that moment when you feel alienated because you haven't done enough homework.
No, and I agree with that. just from a storytelling point of view, it's either got to be Booster or it's got to be Daniel. It's got to be one of those two.
Yeah.
And again, it's just a matter of thinking through the timeline of, you know, how who came back when, who went where, etc. Because the Booster that we have in 52 does feel like the old one from the original Booster Gold series, but timeline wise, is the one who came back with that Skeets in Infinite Crisis. So that's the part I've still got to kind of wrap my mind around.
Yeah, and I forget, when he comes back in Infinite Crisis, it's after the other one leaves, after he leaves the he's part of the attack on the OMAC satellite, right?
And when again, I haven't reread the last issue in the hardback, but he left after Countdown on Infinite Crisis to go back home to the future. He comes back in, like, the first or second issue of Infinite Crisis to go help lead the attack on the satellite. And I thought he stuck around since then.
I think he did, actually, if I remember correctly, yeah.
So I think you've basically got the when he left and when he came back backwards.
Uh-oh.
But even so, I think your basic timeline of events, you know, with, I mean, the possibility of when does Daniel come back, who does he become, et cetera, you know. I think you're on the right track.
Yeah. You're right, though. Yeah, I think I combined two scenes in my mind.
Because, I mean, if they go with my theory and pull, you know, the whole Superwoman stuff out, it's like, that's totally out of left field, and agreed it would be a very unsatisfying ending.
Yeah, but you'll be clapping.
I expect they may bring some of the tech back and explain the powers. In other words, he did the whole Booster Gold thing again, but this time he got it right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no, we'll see. But yeah. So that sounds good to me. Anyway, moving on to quickly to the Infinity Inc. thing. First of all, I love the cleverness of Lex buying that name. To me, I don't know. I mean, I never read the original Infinity Inc. series. That's one of those ones that I would love. I wish they would trade it because I get the feeling I'd really enjoy that. I hear great stuff about it, but you know, it can be expensive to find the back issues. So I don't have that reverence for the name, but to me that's like, I can almost picture a meeting where that name got introduced or something, that name came up, and it's like you could almost imagine Greg Rucka saying, wait, Inc., like it's incorporated, does that mean somebody can buy it? Like, you know, because there is something kind of funny about Infinity Inc. as a name, and there's such a, it would either be Rucka or it would be Morrison playing like imaginative literalist or something, that it's like, well, if it's incorporated, it's a company, it could be bought. Anyway, I just love that Lex bought this name as a property.
Is he going to buy the power company next?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's such a great way to kind of update a name that, you know, I think just sounded cool back in the day or whatever, and now has that sense of, you know, a more modern take on you know, the corporate America that we live in. But anyway, so I love the way that they use the name. As far as where I think that team is going with their connection to Lex and everything, I do feel like as a team, Infinity Inc. is headed for a really terrible, bloody, you know, Titan-esque ripping limbs. And I wonder if, because there's such an emotional connection and so much time being spent on the John Henry Steele and Natasha relationship, if she'll make it out of it. Like, if she'll, you know, so much has been presented about her learning the lesson of needing to earn power. I feel like we'll get some kind of heroic moment, and maybe, I don't know, I keep thinking of that suit that he made her, and I wonder if we'll see her get so horribly injured or burned or whatnot that, you know, Dr. Doom-like, she ends up getting put into that suit that he made for her. And, maybe she's one of the new characters that comes out of 52, but she's got to live in that thing, and she's, you know, gone through this experience and has lost her beauty and her, you know, humanity, in a sense, and learned a terrible lesson of, you know, the cost of being a superhero. But as for the rest of them, I think they're pretty much all fodder.
I would think Natasha's going to come out of it okay. I expect her to be kind of the new big, you know, established hero out of this series. I certainly hope she doesn't get horribly disfigured or whatnot in the process, but I do think she's going to have the major growth curve out of it.
Yeah, I wonder, and it certainly could be, I think the person who's going to end up with the biggest, most heroic Superman moment in this whole thing is John Henry Steele himself.
I agree.
Like I've been trying to track, and his storyline's been sort of tough to love, and I think he gets a lot of flack, and rightly so, that he's kind of, again, you know, you've got this ensemble, and you've got three detectives, and you've got three kinds of heroes. You know, you've got Black Adam as your sort of Miracle Man, Squadron Supreme, Authority-esque anti-hero that's going to change the world by ripping it to pieces if necessary. You've got, I'm losing a character. Oh, you got Booster, who's a, you know, sort of faux fake hero. And then you've got John Henry Steele, who of the six is the most traditional superhero. Like, he, yeah, to me, is written, and his scenes are truly about being this humble, true hero. I mean, the very first thing we see him doing amidst all the stuff that's going on, it's like he doesn't even quite know all of what's happened in the crisis. He's just helping the firemen save people. He's moving wreckage. He's just, you know, he's just being a hero. He's answering the call. And a lot of his storylines have been sort of traditional leading man stuff. And he's got this family thing going on, and he's got, you know, angst to go through, and then, you know, he's going through this transformation. Again, it's been like he doesn't get the good lines, he doesn't get the funny lines the way the Question and Montoya do, but he's slow and steadily going through this as this traditional superhero. And I feel like where he's heading is at the point where Lex's plan fully unfurls. And it's that moment where only Superman could finally step up and save Metropolis or the world from this huge move that Lex has planned and executed. It will instead be Steel doing.
I would agree with that. I just don't see Steel making it out. I almost see, you know, the cover of the next issue being Natasha holding his body.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it could be that he has.
And that may be the growth point for her.
I really hope not.
That's a good point. Yeah, and it would be sort of a waste, although it would be poignant. I mean, if he gets that, you know, one of the things that I love about the Steel character, and to me, he's the best thing that came of the whole Death of Superman thing. I love the notion of, my God, the world doesn't have a Superman anymore, so I'm going to use my ingenuity, and I'm going to fill that hole. I'm going to make myself a Superman because the world needs one. And we, again, are in a year without a Superman. You know, that's what I love about that first issue, that everybody's standing around waiting for Superman to arrive and make a big speech and rally the troops, and he's not coming. So I feel like it would be such a great, and again, it could be his end, it could be what he sacrifices himself to do, but to me, the wonderful thematic breaking point to take John Henry Steele to again is that moment where he steps in where normally we could only expect Superman to save us.
Well,
that's where I see, and I feel like that's tied up with Lex. And so I think he'll be the one that will stop Lex. You know, that certainly we know that Lex does get defeated, but I feel like it'll be Steel or Steel and Natasha that end up rising to the occasion to do it.
I think it'll be Steel who plays the muscle. I think it'll be Clark Kent who takes Luthor down as a reporter. And that'll be Clark Kent's kind of quote-unquote Superman moment as a reporter.
That would be great, yeah. That would be a really great thing to say. Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, though, I can't really see them killing off Steel because, well, then that would be killing off two characters from Reign of the Superman in two giant events. I mean, you've got Superboy dying in Infinite Crisis. I can't really see them killing off Steel because I feel like that would sort of be like going to the pot, you know, one too many times with that.
And they don't have to kill him off. I mean, they just need to get him kind of, quote-unquote, out of play in some respect to where he can't be stealing. I mean, right now he's just a watered-down Colossus almost.
Yeah.
So I think they're going to do something major with him, be it, you know, either cripple him or, you know, depower him or whatever. And depowering makes sense.
Yeah, well, I think he'll end up back in the steel armor because obviously he became the way he did because of Lex Luthor and what we previously stated about the fact that Luthor could take away these powers at any time. He's probably going to try and take away those powers at the worst possible moment for Steel. So he might be the one who ends up in the steel armor due to a giant accident. You know, who knows? We're just going to have to
wait
and see.
Hopefully not the Natasha armor that he made, though, because I
certainly hope
gender,
so.
Gender identity-wise, that would be as confusing as Martian Manhunter.
I would actually.
I think that, you know.
Yeah.
That would just be scary.
Get a Vertigo title, big, but anyway. But yeah, although it's funny, as you guys have talked about it, I don't know. I'm starting to get more convinced that they will kill him. Actually, for on some level, exactly the same reason that they killed the Connor Superboy clone is that to me, if so much of 52 and 1 year later is about kind of streamlining and simplifying some of the brands, you know, getting Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman back to kind of who you knew they were.
Yeah.
I wonder if getting rid of those Reign of the Supermen is a way of simplifying Superman. I mean, don't get me wrong, I think Steel's great, and I think he certainly has his own identity separate from Superman. But I wonder if, you know, if you give him a great, big, heroic, noble death, you have Natasha carrying on the legacy, and of course they love their legacy characters, but Steel, because his origin is so connected to Superman and a period of Superman's history that clearly they don't want to have to deal with much anymore, that it's kind of more streamlining to the line to kind of get rid of him so that there isn't a person out there that has this armor with a Superman insignia on his chest that makes new readers go, who's he? Is that a Superman? Or what? You know, I don't know. I'm starting to get more convinced by what you guys have said for the opposite reason than what you said.
I'm kind of seeing him as more, in some regards, as a supporting character in Natasha's storyline, and certainly he's got his own, though, than vice versa. And I would think that the big climax, and I'm expecting the late, 45 to 50 issues to be just almost nonstop, things happening left, right, and center.
Sure. Well, Rip Hunter's board has promised us World War III. So we do have to, that is one of the things that seems to be ahead, is something of the size of World War III. So I agree, and I think we'll go from small mysteries and character moments to big widescreen storytelling
expecting widescreen so much as just a lot of things, a lot of plot points happening in all these various stories. Mm. So we'll probably hit one issue where conceivably we'll get major plot points for Ralph, for Black Adam, for John Henry Adams, for Supernova, for Clark Kent, for kind of a nexus point, if you will, is the big climax happens. And I would think that I agree that Lex versus Steel is clearly going to be a part of that. I half expect Lex to try to turn off Steel's power. Bam, Steel no longer has his turn into Steel power, and he calls in his armor. He then fights Lex, who, either calls in his armor or whatever. Steel's armor gets damaged. Okay, he's got to rebuild it, whatever. He's out of play for a bit, I mean, there's a lot they can do there.
Sure. What you said about, the notion of Steel being a supporting character in Natasha's book does bring up the question of, when we get to May of next year, when we have to hit that transition point from 52 into not 1 year later, but now the DC Universe 2 years later, it will be interesting to see what books they try to launch out of the events of 52. One of the things that, of course I'm such a big fan of it and things like that, but I will admit that my concern about the back end of 52 will not only be, okay, are they going to be able to pay off all the storylines that they've started in the page space they have, but also when we hit that 52nd issue, because there probably can't be any huge status quo changes because they can't be things that have affected, Justice League and the other books we're already reading. What will we feel like we've gotten out of these 52 weeks? They've made a huge investment of pages and time, and we've read 52 comic books. What will make the readers feel, and I'm enjoying the journey. I mean, I don't think I'm going to expect myself to be disappointed at the end, but for the people who have committed to it, what is it that we feel we need to get out of 52? I mean, is it that we've gotten so hooked into our six main characters that we just want to see what happens to them? And again, it's smart that they've kept them out of regular continuity, so we don't know if they're going to live or die. Is this about launching exciting new properties, Natasha Steele or Batwoman or Super Chief or Supernova or any of these people that we've seen? Or are all these plot lines building up to a climax that'll be so exciting as its own story that it'll finish and be self-contained and we will feel like we got our money's worth? That's sort of my next big question for everybody.
It's about closure, really. I think that's what 52 is all about.
I think we're going to get some of both. I think the main thing that has to happen at the end of 52 is some major event with most of these characters that kind of kickstarts all of the other heroes back into action. Something that closes the, okay, you've had your year vacation, get back to work, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, etc.
Does that kick get delivered to Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman in May of 2007 in their own books, or is it a kick that gets delivered within the pages of 52?
In 52, that basically gets us to where, okay, here's where 1 year later picks up.
Yeah, well, we're going to be getting the Batman story, at least. That much we know. There's going to be a 52-issue down the line. I believe it's going to be drawn by Phil Jimenez, actually, that is going to give us, you know, exactly where they are at this point in the world of 52. And I'm sure we're probably going to get answers about Wonder Woman and Superman pretty soon also, because we're just getting to that point where their stories are going to have to start getting integrated into 52, because this is their missing year,
well,
too.
Do you feel like in reading, let's say, the Batman, Wonder Woman, or Superman books 1 year later, do you feel like when those start that there's that much that's unanswered?
Well, I would actually say...
We've pretty much been told where they've been, we just haven't seen it.
I would say the one that we're going to have to see something of in 52 is Green Lantern.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Without a doubt. And because of the World War III that's going to happen, because obviously that plays a major role into the fact that, a little bit of a spoiler here for his own book and all that, that, you know, China and all these different countries seem to have something against Green Lanterns now for going into their own airspace and all that. This definitely has something to do with that fighting of World War III that's probably going to end up happening here.
Well, we just went enough in-depth of 52 where this is actually going to be a two-part episode here, so I'm going to actually end episode 20 part A here, and episode 20 part B will probably be released either on Monday or Tuesday of this upcoming week, so you'll have plenty of time to listen to this one and listen to a couple other podcasts out there, and then come on back for part B of David D., John Mayo, and myself discussing 52. So let's wrap things up here. The email address for Comic Timing is comictiming@gmail.com. Don't forget to vote for us on Podcast Alley. The links are in the show notes and on the main page. We are proud members of the Comics Podcast Network over at comicspodcast.com. Please check out our forums over at comicgeekspeak.com/forum, which are graciously hosted by the Comic Geek Speak guys over at comicgeekspeak.com. Please give us your iTunes reviews on iTunes. They'll be greatly appreciated, and they draw plenty of wonderful attention to the show. In fact, our Evan Dorkin interview so far is one of our most downloaded episodes of Comic Timing. So we're certainly getting up there. Enough people are listening to this, and I hope they continue to listen to it as time goes on. And your iTunes reviews will certainly assist in that. Our 22 pages for the month of November is going to be Superman Confidential number 1. That's written by Darwin Cook with art by Tim Sale. That comes out on November 1st. So if you haven't put your orders in yet, please go ahead and do so, as that is fastly approaching now. About 2 weeks after that, we will have ourselves our 22 pages discussion, and it will be a crossover episode. I want to keep the surprise going there. And once again, I want to thank John Mayo and David D. for joining me here for Part A. They'll be back for Part B. And I want to remind people to listen to podcasts that are associated with Comic Timing. I say associated because these are people who either had been on the show before or were not on the show this week. Specifically, my usual partner, Matt S., he was MIA this week because on Tuesday he had some family obligations he needed to take care of, and on Thursday, when we actually did record this episode, it's office day for him, so I wanted to make sure that he had plenty of time to watch the episode of The Office, so he will hopefully be back this upcoming week once we're done with episode 20, but I want to remind people to listen to That's What She Said over at thatswhatshesaid.libsyn.com. It's Matt's office podcast, and he will obviously have a recap of this week's office episode this upcoming weekend. And make sure to listen to the Bullpen Bulletins podcast, which is David Price's new podcast with Vince B. Episode 5 has just been released there. You can find that over at bullpenbulletinspodcast.com. And don't forget to listen to Sean and Jim over at Raging Bullets at ragingbullets.com. They have been supporters of the show since the beginning, and I definitely want to plug them there. And other than that, that's pretty much it. So until Tuesday, I'm Ian Levesey reminding everybody that there's always time for comics.